Podcast. I'm your host, Emma Thomas, and my guest today is Professor Jack Gilbert. He's based at the University of California, San Diego, where he's a professor in paediatrics and at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He's an associate vice chancellor for marine science, director of both the Microbiome and Metagenomics Center and the Microbiome Core Facility. That's quite a mouthful. Welcome along to the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Emma.
So you gave the annual lecture at the British Menopause Society conference last year, and that's how your work came to my attention, actually. So my sister-in-law was attending the conference and heard you speak and sort of talked a little bit about some of the really interesting things that you spoke about. So thank you very much for agreeing to come on and sort of translate some of that for a sort of wider non-specialist audience.
Yeah, always happy to try and do scientific communication. I mean, it's important that we give people actual facts and knowledge and details rather than relying on hearsay and variation.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, there is an increasing amount of interest how our microbiome impacts on all kinds of, you know, aspects of health, but especially menopause, that's sort of on the increase. So we know that as we obviously go through that life transition, our estrogen levels drop. So how does that impact the sort of the microbial composition in the gut, and what are the sort of implications of that?
Yeah, so I mean, it's funny, you know, we talk about sex hormones like they act in isolation. Of course they don't, right? There's a whole cornucopia of sex hormones pumping through our bodies on a regular basis, whether a male or female, and understanding their interaction with what we call the microbiome, which is basically these microorganisms that live inside us and on us, in every nook and cranny, as it were, is become a really interesting area of science, right? Something that's been relatively overlooked. Honestly, to answer the question wholeheartedly, I really have to talk about very briefly the fact that everything is connected in the body, right? So sure. I like to think of it more like a whole series of complex feedback cycles. Right. So we have, you know, for example, when your immune system comes dampened down, the immune system is like the gardener that manages the microbial garden inside you. Right. Mm-hmm. It grows the bacteria that it wants to get good products out of, and it tries to weed out the bad ones. Right. And so that if the immune system's impacted, it impacts what kind of bacteria can grow inside you. And invariably, good bad bacteria start to flourish. Well, the same is kind of true. And then those bad bacteria flourish, they pump the body full of pro-inflammatory compounds, and that causes your inflammation system to go haywire.
So is that what you call dysbiosis, when that sort of, that's out of whack?
Yeah, that's a form of dysbiosis. I mean, dysbiosis has to have a mechanistic explanation, right? Otherwise, it's just some kind of hand-wavy concept. And the same is true for an alteration in sex hormones, because things like estrogen, for example, are actually conjugated or bound to bile acids by the human body, right? And released from the bile duct into the gut. So now you've got the body's pumping the intestine full of these bile acids with estrogen stuck to them. And bacteria consume those, right? They utilize them as a fuel source.
Really?
And so, and by doing so, they break apart this bile acid estrogen mix, and then the estrogen goes off. And We believe, although we're working to quantify this, that estrogen then goes back into circulation and is used by the host again. And if you stop producing estrogen, or you ramp down the production of estrogen, then that fuel source goes away. So when we see a reduction in estrogen, either in animals or in people, right, we tend to see increases in proteobacterial organisms. Mm-hmm. These are organisms that are often associated with dysbiosis. They're often associated with increased production of compounds that produce inflammation. So you then get elevated levels of inflammation in the body, which can cause a cornucopia of other problems, right? From depression, anxiety, through to aches and pains, gastrointestinal issues. And so there's a significant shift in the bacterial population in the body when you knock out estrogen.
That's so interesting, because I think a lot of do often wonder why you get such a big sort of spectrum in terms of people's experience of symptoms. So this could potentially be one of the things that kind of has an impact on the amount or the severity of symptoms, sort of how well your your gut is kind of functioning essentially.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, like when we look at the microbiome in women, for example, pre-menopause, post-menopause, we see this shift. And we also see other more subtle shifts. Post-menopausal women, the microbiome tends to look a lot more like a man's microbiome than it does like a pre-menopausal woman's microbiome. So there's that estrogen creates a characteristically female, quote unquote, microbiome, right? You know, it looks like a woman's microbiome. And you can actually tell, if I sequence a microbiome at random, I can generally tell if it's from a man or a woman, if the woman's premenopausal. Postmenopausal, that difference is actually broken down. It's quite different. And so it looks more like a man's microbiome.
So it doesn't return to what it would have been, say, I don't know, as a 10-year-old child.
No, because again, you know, under teens, that's a different ecosystem again altogether. Yeah. Your microbiome tends to change quite dramatically with life, right? Yeah, you know, there's a certain, you could say, like, as a, you know, a pre-menstrual teen, right? You could generally see that there's a signature which tends to reduce the difference between men and women, or boys and girls at that kind of age group, right? So they tend to look more similar than they do post-menstruation or post shift in puberty. But there's this big difference then that lasts up until, you know, between 40 and 60 years old when people start to go through menopause, and then they tend to coalesce a little bit more. But it's not like, you know, they look exactly like a man's microbiome, because men tend to have much more elevated levels of testosterone. But testosterone weans off as you get older, and so generally even pre-puberty and into the 50s, that tends to look quite similar as well. So men's bodies are going through changes, right, as their testosterone level drops. And so, you know, these sex hormones, they play very significant roles in our health. And we think that a lot of that's due to the microbiome mediating that relationship.
Mm-hmm. So we know, because we get told a lot, that we should be trying to you know, get adequate fiber, which a lot of us don't kind of get to the sort of the bare minimum, and eat this really wide range of plants to sort of promote the growth of beneficial gut bacteria. But we don't always hear so much about why. I know that you talked in the lecture a little bit about these sort of short chain fatty acids and the kind of the benefits of having those. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Sort of, because again, those are things that sort of have an impact on that inflammation. Is that the same sort of thing that you were talking about, the sort of the breakdown of the?
Yeah, there's two sides to that coin, right? So our bodies are, and our microbiome are kind of designed to consume a varied diet, right? And we have a lot of bacteria inside us that are very good at breaking down plant fibers, especially soluble fibers, which our bodies aren't very good at digesting, right? So you've got these long chain fibers that pass through our stomach, that pass through our duodenum into our small bowel, and nothing seems to break them down. Then they get into the colon, they encounter this group of bacteria, these bacteria that don't like oxygen, right? So they live in this anaerobic world in the deep inside our intestine, and they love munching on these fibers. And when they munch on these fibers, they poop out short chain fatty acids like butyrate. Butyrate, if you ever concentrate it and or, you know, like purify it, smells like vomit, right? So so it's actually one of the main compounds that contributes towards the smell of vomit. So you but these things, they're produced by bacteria throughout the gut environment, but a massive concentration of them in the intestine, and the body is essentially developed this relationship with these bacteria, right? So over the eons of our evolution, our bodies have learned to leverage those products and use them. So they're actually the main fuel source for all of the cells that line your intestine. And when those cells get a lot of butyrate, these short-chain fatty acids, they become healthy. And then you have a healthy gut barrier, which prevents stuff getting inside out of your colon and into your body, and keeps you healthy and keeps your immune system healthy. Those short-chain fatty acids, that butyrate, they're also a solid fuel source for your immune cells. So you actually get something called regulatory T cells, which kind of accumulate around this butyrate fuel source and dampen down inflammation. So we know we need this, right? We know we need the short chain fatty acids. Our bodies are primed to use them. And the only really solid way to get them is to eat a diverse array of plant fibers. And so our research demonstrated we need around 30 different species of plant each week, right? If you can. And that diversity causes a significant increase in butyrate production and a significant improvement in health. And we've just shown recently that in a study we did across the African diaspora, so using people studying groups from Ghana, South Africa, the Seychelles, but even Jamaica and the United States, that the concentration of fiber you eat is really important, but it's also the type of fiber. And so when we go to rural populations in Ghana, for example, they're consuming a lot of fiber. They're also consuming a lot of fermented foods. And so you've got fiber plus fermented foods, which tend to improve the production of fiber, the production of short chain fatty acids. And you get this really beneficial microbial biomass. And one of my colleagues, Justin Sonnenberg up at Stanford, just did a cool study where he demonstrated that in order to get the body ready to consume a lot of fiber, you do actually have to prime it with fermented foods in order to get those microbes in your gut ready to consume that fiber and start to produce the short chain fatty acids. But it's even more complicated than that, right? But I can't get into all of it. But these short chain fatty acids have receptors over lots of the organs in our body, everything from our liver and our pancreas to our kidneys, right? And so if they're missing, i.e. if you're not consuming enough fiber and your body's not getting enough, it triggers responses throughout the body, right? Everything is connected. Wow. And so it's, you know, the long-term chronic health impacts of not having enough fiber in your body are often not felt immediately by people, but happen over, you know, decades.
Right. The sort of cumulative effect of not having enough of those things, right? That...
So these fad diets that we consume, where we're like, all right, I'm eating crap most of the time, but like, you know, January, February, March, I'm just going to consume, you know, as much healthy food as I can. It just doesn't work, right? You need a long-term relationship with the food in order to have a manifest impact upon your health.
You've talked a bit about fermented foods and sort of pre and probiotics are the other thing that are sort of increasingly popular. Are those worth taking? Do they
depends
kind of
what you want to do. So I mean, there are lots of double-blind placebo-controlled clinical studies. Some are designed better and have better outcomes than others, right? But if you know anything about the clinical trial literature, it's very, very complicated, and it's very, very difficult for a layperson to understand which is a good trial, which is a bad trial. And people produce trials, often by companies paying for them, right? Mm. That are quite often misleading or badly designed.
Small sample sizes, but then
Or not randomized properly, or lacking what we refer to as effective placebo control or effective blinding, or, you know, or generally having weird outcome measures, right, that don't really reflect the impact of the study. So you can twist it which way you want, and, you know, people will find a predatory journal that might publish that, right, on a pay-to-play basis. So it's becoming increasingly hard to actually understand what's a good trial and what's a bad trial. However, there are lots of very good, you know, what I call gold star placebo-controlled studies, which demonstrate that probiotics do have an influence on several markers, right? We see things from anxiety and depression, all the way through to cardiometabolic disease alterations, ones that seem to have a good impact upon a glycemic response to food, upon pre-diabetes, even things like IBS and to a certain extent IBD, so inflammatory bowel disease. So there are there's a range of different approaches which can be valuable, and we know that some of those probiotics are effective. Prebiotics, on the other hand, I mean, they're just nutrients, right? And you need them. Hence, you know, fiber is a prebiotic. But, you know, if you eat a balanced diet, and I'm not talking a super, you know, thunder stinger healthy, like I'm going to become vegan and, you know, only eat chai seeds. I mean, that would be amazing, but it's not going to happen, right? It's just about eating a diverse, balanced diet, not too much of one thing. You know, try and limit the amount of sugar you consume, eat the rainbow, eat enough species of plant. But, you know, having a pork chop every now and again is not a bad thing. And, you know, and consuming food, you know, generally you can, you know, have a soda if you want, as long as you don't have two of them a day. You know, it's, there's balance in the world that's important. And I think it's just about getting into the run of it. But to me, it's diet is the key to a healthy lifestyle. It really is, much more so than pretty much any other factor that we have. And it's probably underlying the vast, vast majority of chronic diseases in our population.
There's research now ongoing into sort of those probiotics as a sort of potential treatment for menopause symptoms, maybe sort of complementary or alternative to HRT and also fecal transplantation. So if no one's heard of that before, can you explain a little bit about how that would work?
Yeah, so a fecal transplant is literally how it sounds. We take the poop out of one person and put it into another person. And it's, you know, it's highly effective at treating things like Clostridioides difficile or C. diff infections. So C. diff infections are chronic diseases where a bacteria called C. diff gets inside your gut and it takes over and it causes massive inflammation and invariably will lead to death in a small proportion of the population. It's actually lethal. However, we treat it with antibiotics, and a lot of people that works and it goes away. For the people where antibiotics doesn't work and the C. diff just keeps on coming back and back and back, we call that recurrent C. diff infections. We found that giving people a fecal microbiome transplant, so we take the poop from a healthy person and we swap out their entire gut contents by spraying the poop up inside their gut, is highly effective. And you get about 92% remission rate, which, you know, is better than pretty much any drug you can get out there. And we actually now have two in the United States, two FDA, Federal Food and Drug Administration approved therapies which leverage almost a pill form or a colorectal version of these mechanisms that have taken bacterial communities, combined them together, and you now just either consume them orally or rectally, and it replaces the gut microbiome. So we're figuring out ways of doing it where you don't just need somebody's poop, right? We can just take this complex consortium. And so these are effective strategies. It's just a case of trying to figure out what they can be used for, right? And in menopause, I've seen a couple of very, very nascent studies suggesting that it could be effective, but we don't have any data to really back that up yet. Not rigorous data. I would say I feel confident that FMT could reduce menopausal symptoms. Probiotics, there definitely is some studies out there, and there's been what I would class as variable but impactful outcomes in some people. And you don't want to throw away a potential therapy just because it works only in 30% of the people, right? That's really important to understand. It might be beneficial for some people, but it might not for others. And so it's hard to say which is the right way of doing things. But I would say, yeah, if you combine healthy eating with a probiotic that does have some evidential data to support its activity, which again, is very hard for the layperson to figure out, right? But if you really want to dig deep, you can find that out. And a probiotic could be beneficial then alongside HRT. Yeah, HRT does have other impact. We know, for example, that HRT does appear to rescue what we would refer to as dysbiosis. So, you know, adding in some estrogen back into the system and progesterone can effectively reduce the buildup of these inflammatory bacteria, improve microbial diversity, and lead to a more balanced microbiome, which feeds back upon the body to reduce inflammation and reduce symptoms. So we know that it can be effective. Well, you know, maybe that plus a healthy diet could be a double whammy, as you were suggesting, like a combinatorial therapy to help people feel a bit more in control. So I call it seed and feed, right? You want the right, you know, like always adding estrogen back in the body is like adding a nutrient back into the body, right? It's like a prebiotic for the bacteria because they consume the products that are associated with it. So it's important that we keep our minds open to multiple therapeutic outcomes, but that we also aren't hoodwinked by a group of people who just say, I've got the next magic pill, right? Which is always usually a waste of money.
But hopefully not lots more research ongoing anyway into those areas. And I'm really interested to hear a bit more as well about how our diet and our gut microbiome play such an important role in the, and I can't pronounce this, so excuse me, it's the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal or HPA axis. Why is that so important? Why should we care about that?
Yeah, so we'll just call it the HPA axis, but it's basically how your body senses stress, right? So if you were, you know, in on the savannas of Africa, and a lion suddenly jumped out from a tree behind you, you'd get that fight or flight response, right? Mm-hmm. And that's driven predominantly by two chemicals your body pumps out, cortisol and adrenaline, right? Which gives you that extra pump. And the cortisol is what keeps you alert and anxious, right? Like, you know, something's going to happen, right? So what we found out is that system can be hijacked by inflammatory bacteria. So, for example, as we've seen, if you go through menopause, you'll see an increase in pro-inflammatory organisms inside your gut. They'll pump out their little compounds like hydrogen sulfide, which is that rotten egg smell, or lipopolysaccharide, which is a potent pathogen-type molecule, which the body sees as a presence of pathogens. And so this triggers inflammation, first in the gut, but then the inflammation travels throughout your bloodstream and your lymph system to pretty much every organ in the body. And it travels through that way to your brain, and you get neuroinflammation in your brain, where the inflammation starts to become hyperactive. And that neuroinflammation triggers the HPA axis. So you may be, you know, sitting in the most comfortable chair, surrounded by candles and perfectly at zen with the world, right? And
everything get hijacked.
Great. Yeah, yeah. But you could be there, it'd be wonderful, but your body, as you say, your brain's been hijacked by this inflammatory response, and it's pumping your blood full of cortisol. And so now you have this elevated level of anxiety, where there's no reason to be anxious, but your body is on high alert. And we actually think that this is, you know, if you're eating an unhealthy diet, if you're, you know, exposed to elevated levels of pollution, like many of the poorest people in our community are, that you can end up with this elevated level of cortisol in your body's system on a permanent basis, yeah. Which you may not experience as manifest, you know, hyper anxiety modes, but it causes this low level, this low grade of chronic anxiety. And that chronic anxiety causes, you know, can, if you have another situation where you become extremely stressed, like you run out of money, or you have a fight with your boyfriend or whatever, right? Then you're going to have a severe anxious episode because you already have a background.
Your baseline is already kind of up here, higher yeah. than it should be.
And we didn't know this before. So this relationship between gut inflammation and the HPA axis was hinted at, but never really demonstrated. But now we can do it. I can take a mouse or a rat, for example, and put these bad bacteria inside it, and the mouse will become hyper anxious, right? And it will have chronic anxiety. And I can rescue that by adding other types of bacteria back into the animal. So we found several species of bacteria that when you add them in, they produce chemicals which dampen down local inflammation. And that reduction in inflammation disseminates throughout the body, causes a reduction in neuroinflammation, and it shuts down that HPA axis and your cortisol levels go down. So we think some of the probiotics on the market that have been demonstrated to have in a placebo-controlled double-blind randomized trial have been shown to be effective at reducing anxiety are doing it through that mechanism. They're producing compounds which reduce inflammatory responses in the gut.
That is absolutely fascinating. And then in terms of sort of other things that can have a sort of negative impact, if you like, on that kind of gut flora, what's the sort of the latest in terms of things like sort of painkillers, anti-inflammatories, antibiotics?
Yeah, so I mean, we use analgesics or painkillers very regularly. Certain painkillers like acetaminophen. Ibuprofen is pretty chill, doesn't really seem to do anything to the microbiome, but acetaminophen does, and bacteria consume acetaminophen and poop it out as acetaminophen sulfate. So they actually add a sulfate molecule to it, and that can cause liver disease, so liver cirrhosis. And in many people, you know, we actually have around 20,000 deaths a year in the US that are attributable to excessive acetaminophen consumption. And yet it's still a non-controlled substance. You can buy it at any store in any quantity you want. And it's regularly touted as an effective painkiller. That's a different mechanism, but we've identified that people with the wrong kind of bacteria in their intestine will break it down, and it will give them liver cirrhosis if they consume it at high enough levels. But yeah, so antibacterials are a highly effective mechanism for treating disease. And we know that they're effective, but They can also lead to the promotion of organisms, which will cause elevated levels of inflammation. And in our studies focused on surgery, for example, we've shown that antibiotics can wipe out a lot of the bugs, which would keep some of the other bugs that are actually antibiotic resistant in check, right? So when those, when the, all the rest of the community is gone, these weeds can suddenly grow up. And those weeds are generally really bad for your health, right? It can cause major problems. And in surgery, we've seen they can cause surgical site infections, they can cause systemic inflammatory responses, and lead to worse outcomes during surgery. And a lot of those bugs that grow up like weeds are promoted by eating the exact kinds of foods which we know are bad for us, but we eat anyway, right? And they, so if you're eating a high sugar, high saturated fat diet on a regular basis, then you know you're consuming it a lot, and you're doing that right before surgery, you've already got elevated levels of these bugs in your gut. And then you go in for surgery, or you're going for a medical procedure, you take antibiotics, and these bugs suddenly become super abundant because everything else has gone away, and they cause a massive health risk. So once you understand why doing something is bad, right, and when doing it is bad, you can come up with strategies to deal with it. I always tell people, if you're going to go in for surgery or you're going to go in for a medical procedure, eat as healthy as you can for like the month or two beforehand, right? Let's reduce any probability that there's going to be a significant problem. You know, cut out the sugar, cut out saturated fats, and just try and eat as healthy. It's not easy to eat like a monk, but if you can, it would be beneficial.
It would improve chances. All right, let's move on to something a bit more positive. We sort of hear a lot about the sort of the beneficial impact of spending more time in nature, sort of green spaces, blue spaces. But how kind of close up do we need to get in terms of sort of, I guess, helping our kind of microbiota? Sort of, you know, do we actually need to kind of get our hands dirty? Can we just go and sort of hug a tree?
This is really complicated, and we don't know. I mean, it's funny. I once put a proposal into the National Institutes of Health, who are our main federal funding agency for getting research grants to do health research. And I suggested I wanted to develop a mobile van that had lots of animals in it, like farm animals and farm soils. And I wanted to go into poor communities in urban Chicago, for example, and bring these animals into babies' lives, right? So a lot of the kids that grow up in urban America cannot or have no real way of getting access to a farm. So I bring the farm to them. And the major criticism came back, well, do you know how long the kids have to be exposed to the farm animals? And how much physical contact do they require? And, what's the dose-dependent response of this therapeutic intervention? And I still don't have an answer for it because I can't do the research to find out. But the way we got around that is we're working with communities up in Washington State right now, and a brilliant new early career professor called Amber Fife-Johnson. And what Dr. Fife-Johnson's doing is she's taking children that are joining some of these forest schools or these outdoor schools that are becoming popular in Europe, United Kingdom and America, and examining those populations in contrast to children in the same community attending a regular school, and looking at health outcomes like obesity, anxiety, physiological health-based disturbances. And indeed, the children that tend to go to the forest schools and spend more of their day outside in school have lower levels of obesity, have lower levels of anxiety. The question still remains, well, how much of that is just due to the fact that it's nicer being outside, right? Versus the anti-inflammatory effects that we know exist of being exposed to a diverse series of antigenic responses and bacterial responses that you get from breathing in the dust that comes off of plants or off of soil, right? And we still don't know the answer to that. We do know that there are bacteria that grow in soil that, alive or dead, can have an antidepressant effect, right? So it's just being exposed to the antigens, these compounds that line the cells of bacteria and fungi, for example, that when they get into your body, your immune system sees them. Those antigens tend to have a dampening effect, right, on the immune system and support immune health. versus ones that are identified as being pathogenic, like that LPS I talked about earlier, or hydrogen sulfide. So we think that that's important. It's so hard to disentangle it in humans. We can do it in rats and mice, but in humans, we just do not have enough control over a child's life to be able to really dictate what this complex series of relationships is actually doing. But yeah, I mean, I suggest even in later life, gardening seems to have a positive impact upon mental health. Being outside more, probably the amount of daylight you get, but also being exposed to these antigenic products. I can't disentangle how much of an effect each of those factors makes, but I know that they definitely make an impact. So it's one of those maybe current scientific mysteries where we know that there's some aspect of both of them that's important, but I can't tell you definitively what you should do other than you should get outside and garden. So maybe just do that.
Start somewhere. Is there any evidence that the sort of differences in sort of diversity and health of the microbiome can affect our decision making, thinking about the sort of gut, you know, we talk about gut feeling?
We've shown it can definitely affect. So changes in the microbiome appear to be associated with how hungry we are, and with our propensity towards snacking and our choice of snacks. So we can, for example, make an animal crave sugar or not. We can see that trait in humans. We can correlate shifts in the microbiome with a craving for sugar or an absence of a craving for sugar. That's reasonably well established. We still don't fundamentally understand the mechanism. We have some hypotheses, but we don't, you know, haven't proven it yet. But we know that that happens. Okay. We also know that baseline anxiety that we get if we have a pro-inflammatory microbiome, which triggers the HPA axis due to the levels of cortisol in your bloodstream, that anxiety tends to degrade the competency of your decision making. It's like almost like being a little bit drunk, right? You know, you're making decisions, but you're making decisions without understanding the consequences, right? You get a similar state of affairs because it's a fight or flight response when you have that elevated cortisol in your bloodstream, right? You're making decisions that are less informed or less long term, right? You're making a decision sort to get the hell out of that situation, right? A knee-jerk reaction. So we know that, that can have an impact, but decision-making processes are very, very complicated, and there's a whole neuroscience angle that we haven't unpacked yet. And so we're still working on the science to really understand that fundamental connection.
And then I wanted to ask maybe just briefly about serotonin. So I can't remember exactly how much of it is apparently a huge amount is made in the gut itself.
About 80%.
80%. Can that pass out of your gut and into your bloodstream? Yeah.
So what actually happens is the bacteria produce what we refer to as a serotonin precursor. So they break down an amino acid, one of the constituents of all the proteins that make up pretty much everything you see and eat, called tryptophan. They break it down, and some bacteria break it down and produce this serotonin precursor, a molecule which is then taken up by the guts, the cells that line your guts, right? And they and several other cells break it down and transform it into serotonin. So it's actually... it's these serotonin precursors that are getting out of the gut into the body and making large quantities of serotonin by the body's own cells, right? So it's a partnership. And now what we don't understand is what the actual relationship is between that and, say, brain health. We know that the serotonin that your gut produces is used to regulate things like peristalsis, so like the movement of food through your intestine, that flexing motion as the gut pumps stuff through. We know that it can influence inflammation in the gut. We know it can influence some hormonal action in the gut, and things like even being shown to be partially associated with how your body regulates insulin production and incretin production by the pancreas. So we know that those things happen. What we don't understand is what the overt production of serotonin in the gut, what relationship that has upon serotonin production in the brain. We don't think that the gut serotonin significantly complements brain serotonin.
That's what I was wondering about, because I think there's a lot of talk about how much serotonin is manufactured in inverted commas in the gut and the impact of that. But actually, it sounds like that's a big unknown.
Well, it's just we haven't seen any value, well, what's the word? I haven't seen any evidence which where I would go, oh, absolutely. If you're producing more serotonin in the gut, we see elevated levels of serotonin in the brain. And I haven't seen that data. We've seen lots of data where we can manipulate, and we published this in rats, for example, where we can manipulate the microbiome of the gut and it will increase serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA production, whole suite of neurotransmitters in the brain can be increased in proportion by changing the gut bacteria of the animal. But I've never been able to fundamentally link that to elevated levels of serotonin production in the gut.
Well, we're almost out of time. Maybe one last question. If you could run any experiment, carte blanche to do whatever you want, what would it be?
So we just built a device called the Gut Lab. We farmed it out to a small startup company, but it's a molecular biology laboratory in a box that sits in a bathroom. And you basically punch in your PIN code in the top and it flips open and you drop a piece of used toilet tissue in there. This allows us to collect every single stool sample that someone produces. What I'm really, really keen to do is have a whole suite of women from diverse cultures and diverse dietary practices go through a period of, you know, a perimenopause. So I get them before, during, and afterwards, and just collect every stool sample. So, you know, I've reduced the cost of doing the metagenomic analysis by 90%. It now costs, to get a microbiome analysis, I can do it for less than $30, right? It's really, really cheap, but comes with a little bit of a hiccup to do the study I'm talking about, because women's menopausal action can occur pretty much sporadically. We don't have any triggers where we're going, okay, it's definitely going to happen at 44 or 45. I've got to recruit probably 300-400 women, maybe 100 from Ghana, 100 from the UK, 100 from China, you know, wherever, and follow them over a prolonged period of time. So we need to collect tens of thousands of samples. And what I really want to see is whether the bacterial changes are associated before menopause happens with menopausal symptoms afterwards. So I want to see if we can predict menopausal symptoms in a premenopausal women based upon microbial communities. So I believe we can. It's just you need a very, very big clinical study to be able to demonstrate it.
That sounds amazing. I hope it happens. Thank you so much for your time. It is absolutely fascinating. And who knows what we'll be talking about in another 10 years when the science has moved probably stratospherically forward again. Thank you. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Thank you, Emma. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Middling Along podcast. Do remember to subscribe to be notified when our next episode is live. And why not visit the blog at www.middlingalong.com to sign up to my newsletter as well. I do hope you enjoyed listening today. If you did, I'd be really grateful if you would consider leaving a short review, as that helps people find the podcast and helps get it noticed. Hope you can join us next time. Goodbye for now.